Sunset Lake CBD is a majority employee-owned hemp farm located right outside of Burlington, Vermont. Before they started growing hemp, Sunset Lake Farms produced cream for Ben & Jerry's. Sunset Lake CBD doesn't use any pesticides or herbicides to grow any of its hemp plants, and they use organic fertilizer and other sustainable farming techniques to ensure the long-term health of the soil and to minimize their carbon footprint. So like all of us, my days are really stressful. By the end of the night, my kids are in bed, I'm taking a minute to chill, but I'm still unwinding. I recently started using the Relax Gummies infused with CBD isolate, reishi mushroom extract, and ashwagandha root extract. I'm really glad I tried these because they really helped me get ready for a good night of sleep, and I really think I sleep better, so I'd highly recommend it. Check out Sunset Lake CBD today at sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. That's sunsetlakecbd.com and use the code UNDERMINE for 20% off your order. Farmer-owned, Vermont-grown, Sunset Lake CBD. Hey listeners, I want to tell you about Music Masters Collective, a nonprofit organization that produces unique music events, providing opportunities for fans and artists to meet and collaborate in an inspired and creative atmosphere. These events give you the opportunity to learn from world-class musicians like the Fab Four, Steve Earle, Richard Thompson, John Scofield, Nels Klein, the Milk Carton Kids, and many more. This June, join the Wait Band, featuring members of the band and the Levon Helm Band with special guests, including Jimmy Vivino, Bob Margolin, Lost Leaders, Chris O'Leary, Cindy Cashdollar, Stony Creek Band, Rob Fraboni, Larry Packer, and so many more at Camp Cripple Creek. This all-inclusive music vacation in the Catskill Mountains of upstate New York promises to be a once-in-a-lifetime experience featuring performances, workshops, jams, comfortable lodging, and superb dining. Visit campcripplecreek.com/undermine to register today. That's campcripplecreek.com/undermine.
Osiris.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to season four of Undermine, the Undermine podcast by Osiris Media. I'm Tom Marshall, your host of these proceedings. And we're incredibly at episode 34. How did we do that? In a season where we have been waiting to highlight shows in the wonderful Fall 97 tour where Phish destroyed America. And I'm pleased to say we're deep into that tour now with a show from November 26, 1997 in Hartford, Connecticut. And I'm here with the affable but pragmatic dictator of Osiris, my co-host, RJB. Hi, RJ.
Hey, Tom. Today, we are moving on to Hartford to talk about 11-26-97, a tape I celebrated gloriously when I received it later in 97. Like most Fall 97 shows, this has kind of a little bit of everything from a great tweezer. I wore my special shirt today to commemorate that song. And a tweezer opener and jammed out versions of songs you wouldn't normally hear. And we're excited to get into it. Before we do, I will say, as I always say, please consider supporting our new Osiris premium offering, which you can join for just a few bucks a month. You can get bonus episodes, ad-free episodes, access to all the old Under the Scales interviews, and a lot more. OsirisPod.com/premium. And we know that a lot of people have been asking us to come on the show. We are totally booked for the entire season, but we really want to hear from you. So send us a video clip of you talking about whatever show you want to talk about, 60 seconds max, post it on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, tag Osiris Pod. And we're going to go through all of them. I've seen a few already. We're going to choose a contributor at random, and they will win a handwritten copy of the lyrics to Ghost from Tom Marshall. All right, Tom Marshall, what is happening now?
Right now, I'm going to announce who our guest... Oh, shoot. I let him in too early. I normally announce our guest and give him an intro or her an intro. Scott, I brought you in too early. So let me do my introduction to you anyway. We are pleased to have again as our guest back on Undermine, the infamous Scott Marks. Scott Marks is Biz Archive on Twitter, always tweeting a ton of relevant fish facts. He live tweets the set list during shows. He's a board member of the fan-run volunteer organization Mockingbird, which amazingly recently surpassed 2 million in gifts to music education. Scott is always on tour and always available to help fish fans in any way, including monetary grants of any size. Just ask him. Scott Marks, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's so nice of you to just give money to random fans if they just come up to you and ask you.
I'm glad to help out the community any way I can.
All right. Well, we're going to make sure that they know to do that. Scott, we're absolutely thrilled to talk to you again. And last time we were in Amsterdam in July, and now it's November and we're back in the US 4 months later, and fish is slaying it. And are they more serious than they were in Europe the previous summer? What's the main difference?
I think the main difference is that you had a concept that kind of was starting out with the funk that was now full blown. Night after night, you were going to find one, two, three, several jams that had that funk feel to it. And this Hartford show was right up there with anything else in the tour.
Absolutely. And I should say for the record, and I haven't yet had full verification, I didn't keep good notes or good ticket stubs, but two of my tour buddies claim that I was there, and looking at this set list, it looks extremely familiar, but I'm still getting verification from one guy who is infallible, my friend Scott Herman, and he hasn't answered me yet, but I'm pretty sure I was at this show. Anyway, RJ, what's going on?
I don't know if you were there, if that's your question, but I would assume that you are. That you are there still. So this is Scott, this was their second show at the Hartford Civic Center. They played there in the fall of 96, and they had actually only previously played one show in Hartford at Trinity College, but then Hartford went on to become this like legendary venue for fish, which is awesome. And this happens to be your first show, which is awesome. You mentioned the kind of full blown funk. It's interesting, 'cause like starting with this tweezer and just the whole show, I feel like we're in this like different, more serious darkness funk, but that's a little bit less like, it just feels a little more serious and a little bit dark. But I'm just curious, what was it like going to your first show, and how did you make it to your first show? And then we can start talking about that tweezer.
So I grew up in West Hartford, one town over, and they had played at the University of Hartford in West Hartford in 93. And I hadn't even heard of the band at that point. I didn't hear about fish until 94, and was in the wrong part of the state for 95 when they were in New Haven, and 96 when they were in Hartford. Then finally had my chance in 97. I had just come home for Thanksgiving break, Thanksgiving weekend from college. I had no car, so I literally was driven to the Civic Center, dropped off, and then picked up like 3 hours later. And I went in there and I ran into one person I knew before the show in the concourse, and then was on my own throughout the entire night. I did keep a set list. I had an RA that year, my freshman year at college, who had kept set lists, and I kind of immediately adapted to that. And so I had like a two pieces of paper with like one side has one set list and the other side has the other. And I had a couple of people or a couple of songs I needed help with, and much different now where people will ask me for songs, and I'll know a bunch of people that are around me at shows or that I walk in with. But you know, I had tapes. And I had pretty much, I think I had all the CDs at that point. I was just really excited to finally have that chance to see my first show. And I did one show in 97, then 8 in 98, and did over 20 in 99. And so the rest is history. I just kept doing more and more.
So were you expecting a tweezer opener? What were you expecting versus how this show started to unfold?
I had no expectations. I'm pretty sure I wasn't looking at set lists at that point. I got involved with like Gay Deals board a year later and was looking to set lists on Fishnet in fall 98. But at that point, I don't think I really had any clues to what was going on. I didn't know about the rest of the tour. So there was definitely a level of noobness at that point going into that first show.
I mean, we have to just talk about the Tweezer for a second, just because this, I mean, first of all, an opening first set Tweezer is just like, what else could you ask for? But there's like, as the tour evolves, there's more of this kind of like, there's funk, but there's also a little bit more kind of blissful kind of jamming a little bit in there. There's a lot going on there. And I feel like these shows, the transitions were great. And this whole first set is great. Scott, what's your take on this Tweezer and how do you describe it?
It's one of my favorite Tweezers. Right out the gate, you get an 18-minute song and I just really, really enjoyed it. And you know, it had some funk. It didn't have as much as other versions throughout the tour. I feel like Hampton had a little more to it. But you could definitely feel it. I listened to the show again at work this morning to kind of refresh my memory. And, you know, there's certain things that pop out and the Tweezer was definitely one of them. You start the show out with something like that. And it's just, it's a fantastic way to get things going.
It's really, really great. But they did this a lot in this tour, the segue into Sparkle and then into Gumbo, which was also a really nice jam. I think that's just one of the, I guess, side effects of them being so together in 97, like the segues were just awesome. And that whole first set has a bunch of really cool segments. What are some of your other highlights, Scott?
The Gumbo is fantastic. You look at Gumbos now where they're, you know, 3-4 minutes and don't really go anywhere. And this is 10-12 minutes and gets out there. And it's an interesting jam. And I definitely enjoyed that. And you got McGrupp, which was a rarity even by 97 standards. And I mean, the whole set just had a good song selection. You had a couple of good jams to go with everything else that fit in there.
I will second the motion on McGrupp. And I know you weren't asking me, RJ, you're asking our guest, but my set one highlight is McGrupp. The version is perfect. I can't think of a better one. As you said, Scott, there's not that many McGrupps. However, when they played them, they were amazing in 97. Like I mentioned to RJ, McGrupp, and he mentioned quickly two others that like immediately were either as good or better than this one. But this one's kind of my favorite that I've heard, and we've been re-listening, as you know, to tons and tons of shows. And I think it's possibly because of what Page does, the quiet piano breakdown, and then the way that Trey comes in with some tasty stuff before, and it gets like just deliciously chaotic before the composed section comes back. I really, really love this McGrupp. It's probably my favorite McGrupp.
It's really good. I think the that's something, and we've made this point on other shows from this season, but it's not just that they were like having these great funk jams, right? They were kind of able to do it all. Like there's some beautiful like transcendent jams in these shows, and like this McGrupp, it's a good example of a show where like it's kind of, you know, it's pretty wild. Like Tweezer, Sparkle, Gumbo, My Soul, and then McGrupp is like they're able to get like quiet and, you know, and then kind of bring it back. I feel like that takes a lot of skill, especially in like, you know, a raucous arena in the Northeast where they're like starting to really like hit their stride in this tour. The Taste that closes out the set is also really cool. Taste and Theme in 97 were just both, I think, really great songs just because they allow that kind of like slow buildup over time. I think that Taste, it was like a great set closer for 97. We don't see that anymore.
Yeah. A challenging song to play. And they, of course, were note perfect for every single one in this tour. Taste was no exception. That it's a kind of a tough song. It sounds like it's a tough song to play. I've never learned it myself, but it was perfect. And it's a great ending to this set. And unless Scott has something to say about the Taste, it might be a good time to take a quick break. What do you say, Scott?
That was a great way to end this set, and you start the set with another Billy Breathes song. So it's kind of bookends at the end of the start.
Perfect. All right. So time to talk more about the music in the second set when we return after this quick break.
Hey, listeners, I want to tell you about one of our great partners, DistroKid. DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads and artists keeping 100% of their royalties and earnings. If you're a musician and looking to get your music out there, DistroKid is the way to go. DistroKid is available for iOS and Android and is now available in Apple's App Store and the Google Play Store. More than a million artists rely on DistroKid to get their music onto Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, and all other major streaming services. And with DistroKid, you can upload new releases, see your financial progress, get notified when you've earned royalties, withdraw money from the app, view and share links, check your streaming stats, and a whole lot more. DistroKid has more features than any other music distributor. Check them out today. Go to distrokid.com, that's DistroKid with a capital K, .com/VIP/undermine for a special offer only for our listeners. That's DistroKid, capital K, .com/VIP/undermine. Thanks, DistroKid.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you'd cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Freights from the Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective, the only podcast you crank up to 11.
And we are back, and our guest today is the famous Scott Marks.
Scott, this set to Character Zero, sort of a surprise of the show, but I guess it probably maybe shouldn't have been a surprise, just given how many songs were jammed out. This is the longest version ever, so let's just talk about it. I mean, this is and your first show again, so you're getting a really thrown into the deep end here.
It's mind blowing. For most of the song's history, you've had it showing up as a set closer, an encore. It's essentially arena rock fish, and it works out well in that angle. And then all of a sudden you have something that's going over 20 minutes right out of the gate. And then you really didn't see that at all until last year and this year. Where Zero got jammed out a little bit. And so I think threw everybody for a loop. And I had nothing really to compare it outside of like Billy Breathes at that point, the album. And all of a sudden, you know, here it is. I didn't know it was an arena rock song because I wasn't listening to shows nonstop. But it's like you catch something like that and you don't catch it again. And you wait for it and you wait for it and you wait for it. And then finally, over 20 years later, it kind of comes back into that style a little bit. It's still not quite the same as this, but it was something where you look at shows now where any song can really be jammed out. And it really wasn't that situation back in the 90s. And then all of a sudden there was this zero. You know, Julius got jammed out once that tour. So I mean, it could happen, but it was not a frequent basis, like more like it is now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. I mean, this is in this version, I mean, it's a lot of Trey playing, and it's kind of a little bit heavier than what we hear in like some of the pure funk jams. You know, this is just like, I don't know. I feel like it's starting to get, like I said earlier, like this tour, it's starting to get a little dark in a really fun way. And this is, I mean, 20 minutes of just pure madness. We've only seen, like you said, Scott, I mean, I guess in Orange Beach in 2022, there was a jam, Character Zero jam. Like besides that, you don't see them much anymore. So like, I don't know, maybe that's the next song to come back.
If I want to say it happened at Atlantic City this year as well, which threw me for a loop, one of the first sets. So it's happened a couple of times where it didn't happen, period. It's like you'd hear the song start and you knew what you were going to get. Now you're not so sure anymore. Even MSG, during the April run, you had the, Character Zero going back into Character Zero again. And just your jaw kind of drops to the floor when all of a sudden they threw something in the middle of Zero and they nailed it. So they're certainly playing around with the song a lot more now than they did for a long time.
Yeah. Which is amazing. Tom, this is one of the songs that it's one of my favorite set closers just because it allows you to really like really let loose and rock out. But I feel like this is probably one of the songs where people know the lyrics and they're yelling them, but probably have no idea what they're actually saying. Do you know what they're saying?
Yeah, I can help with the lyrics, but it occurred to me when Scott said that this is an arena rock song, it occurred to me that like, so I was in the Cayman Islands, I think in early 95 with Trey on a songwriting and scuba diving trip. We both had our PADI licenses that we had already written for that. That earlier we'd written Theme from the Bottom. So we had an art song and we'd written Waste. So we had a ballad. I'm wondering if Trey, like in the back of his head, like a good fisherman, you know, has to have every kind of lure in his tackle box. I wonder if he was like, you know, it's time for, however, the way that it did come about was very random. And it was, you know, we went to the undeveloped, the east side of Cayman Island. On the west, there's like, you know, glistening famous beach and tons of hotels. But Trey and I went to the undeveloped side, away from people and away from everything on that coast. And we were at this little mini resort with one dive boat, and the roads to get there weren't paved. And so we'd rented this tiny little Suzuki SUV, and Trey was the designated driver. He loved dirt roads and actually was kind of an expert at driving on them from living in Vermont. Like in New Jersey, where I live, there's pavement everywhere, but not so much in Vermont and definitely not on the east side of Grand Cayman in 1995. So anyway, while he drove, I would tune maybe between three stations on the terrible AM radio in the car. And if I found music, we would blast it and sing our own words and just crack each other up. And one of those was a song, and I have no idea what the actual words were. I probably wouldn't recognize the song if I heard it again, because we co-opted it. We sang on top of it. But before long, we were singing, "I got to see the man Mulcahy, and I got to be the man Mulcahy." We were just, and we thought it was the funniest thing ever. And I don't necessarily know, apart from that the word Mulcahy sounded like something in the song, what that even means. But when we got back to our hotel, we immediately wrote that song with a chorus, because we both know the rule is never ignore your muse when she gives you a song. And so, and although this time the muse was the man, Mulcahy. but right away, because of our laughter and our exuberance, it became a full-on rocker.
That is amazing. I don't know if I've heard that story before, but I haven't. Yeah. Okay. Great.
It was great.
Yeah. Lots of fun. I remember telling some people, you know what? I think it was, I remember telling some people recently about that, but I think it was at a lunch. I think it was at this lunch I recently went to, where there was like five Phish fans at the lunch. That's it. That actually is it. Cause I remember I was like, oh shit, did I just tell this? Did I just tell this story twice on Undermine? Anyway, there it is. The man.
Mulcahy. That is awesome. thanks for sharing that, Scott. So this is like, you know, this jam is 20 minutes and then you go straight into 2001, which is always a crowd pleaser, but this one is really cool. And I think maybe a little bit more what we were expecting, or what we come to identify with Fall 97.
You know, you're talking in the first part of this podcast about transitions, and this is it right here. The 2001 into the cities, into the Yamar. A couple of years ago, Kevin Shapiro released Character Zero as one of the From the Archives tracks. And super excited to have a soundboard of that. But I'm also a little jealous of the other shows in this tour. Like, you look at the previous three nights the tour all got Live Phish releases, and I'm just waiting for this, waiting. But the 2001 gets out there a little bit and just settles into this fantastic funky groove, and then all of a sudden Cities pops up and it's in a different key, and then they fix it, and man, I've listened to this so much, and not just because it's my first show, but just because it's such a great three song transition sandwich, if you will, and it's fantastic, and it's peak Phish from that era. And, you know, just it goes to show you don't need to have a 20-minute jam to have something really work out. And it's great music.
Man, it's really cool that, and the end of the cities is just like some of these shows, like you can't really even tell where it comes from. It just like, it happens so smoothly and so seamlessly. It's really, really great. And, you know, getting like a mid-second set Yamar punch you in the eye, Caspian, I feel like nowadays people would like look at the set list and be like, okay, I guess the show kind of dropped off there. But this doesn't feel like any drop in energy. It's sort of like the punch you in the eye is also like, it's really kind of intense. You know, they're like, they're pushing hard the whole time.
It's a strange placement for the punch you in the eye deep in the second set. But it worked. I don't think the Yamar is really a drop off in energy. Caspian is a little bit, but in the same sense, you just kind of, you know, played all out for 40, 50 minutes. I think you're entitled to have a 5-minute breather, if you will. And you know, Caspian was, again, Billy Breeds and was still being played heavily at that point. So it makes sense for that to show up.
And it's a really good version, the Caspian. There's really great guitar playing there from Trey. And then Poor Heart like kind of starts as Rocky Top. It's definitely not a normal start to Poor Heart in the Tweezer reprise to close it out. I mean, this is a really great first show. And Scott, I I have to mention the jam charts, the tour specific jam charts for Fall 97. There's 8 entries for this show, which is, you know, for a tour that's filled, and there's a lot of them on a lot of shows, but 8 jam chart entries on your first show is it's pretty awesome. And it's also a really cool resource.
It feels like the show is a dark horse. A lot of other shows get a lot of attention from the tour, and rightfully so. You have the Runaway Jam two shows later, and you look at Dayton and just a bunch of other shows. Denver was Live Fish, and the Hampton, North Carolina shows, and then there's Hartford, which has 8 entries on the jam chart. And it's one of your lesser known shows, if you will, and there's still so much packed into this.
RJ, with your clear way of describing things, could you tell my wife, who right now is exercising while listening to our podcast, wondering what the heck jam charts are?
Well, Scott's more intimately familiar with them, but
Raspberry is my favorite.
Yeah, exactly. It's all different kinds of jam. Okay, jam charts are, and Scott, correct me where I'm wrong, they are a compilation by song and then by tour of where notable jams occurred. So there's a jam chart entry for song. So you go to the Bathtub Gin jam chart and you see every notable version that, and particularly jammed out versions. And then there are critical versions, which are highlighted in yellow. It gets to this level of granularity. So if you want to see like, where were the biggest Mike song jams ever? You can just go to Fishnet, go to the song Mike song, and look at the jam chart. And there are tour focused ones. So this Fall 97 tour, which we can link to, you can see every jam chart entry for the entire tour. Scott, did I mostly get that right?
Yeah, that was great. It's such a great entry level thing for Fish fans. If you're just getting to the band and you want to know more about a certain song, or even if you've been listening to this band for 20, 30 years and you want to do a deeper dive, there's really something for everybody. You might hear something and forget about it and you're like, oh, all right, I'm going to go listen to this. And then there it is. So the team that puts that together deserves a lot of credit. It's a lot of work, and it's a fantastic resource on the site.
And the site
really
being,
is
the site being fish.net.
Yes.
Fish.net. But you know, what's interesting is that who decides what's a critical or like a, you know, the yellow highlighted version, or whether something gets to be on there? Is there's a whole decision-making process that exists?
There's a team that's involved with that. I'm not part of it. I might offer my 2 cents every so often, but I usually just stay in my own lane. There's definitely, I would imagine, a decision-making process. I never really asked them, you know, how they go about putting that all together.
It's best not to look in too deeply and find who the board of directors is on things like the set list committee or the jam chart committee, because I have a feeling it's like there's 3 people that we know really well that we don't, you know, that are on there, and they're on all the committees and they're dictating what we listen to.
Stonecutters Club of Fish.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's fair. Well, I know that, you know, teases also, that's a whole different area where we can't even get into that. Scott, what happened when you left the show? That you saw more.
Hold on. Wait, we have to talk about the encore.
Please.
Yeah. So you're talking about Dark Fish, and I think the cavern is pretty dark. And then Trey's going into the old lyrics.
That's what I wanted to talk about.
It's not like an upbeat cavern. It just gets really dark in the middle of the jam and stretches out a bit.
So he forgets. Like, he only remembers the second half of the lyric. He he uses a word, the B word for woman, that I'm not going to repeat because it's been bred out of my vocabulary. But he leaves out the first part. You can hear him muttering something. And the actual lyrics are, and I will credit this entire phrase to my friend Scott Herman, who co-wrote these lyrics with me. The brothel wife then grabbed the knife and slashed me on the tongue. I dropped the B. I don't want to say it. I don't even want to say it. And dropped her in the dung. I grabbed the knife from the B and dropped her in the dung.
Yeah, he definitely misses the first half of those lyrics.
Yes. Yeah.
And then repeats, then decides he likes the word dung a lot and repeats it a second time in the jam.
And it does add
dropped
to the
dung. Dropped her in the dung.
Yeah, dropped her in the dung over and over. Yeah, and it does. It adds to the darkness. And again, it's one of those where I think people, you know, left like, what was going on? Scratching their heads. What is that all about?
If you, listen carefully in the first set, Cell in the Morning, page changes the lyrics to Morning Sickness as well. So there are also all these little lyric things that are thrown in throughout the show. That one's a lot more subtle than obviously the ultimate lyrics to Cavern, which have shown up every so often.
Oh, instead of Morning Stillness, it's Morning Sickness.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if was someone 97. I was wondering if anyone was pregnant and was experiencing morning sickness. Interesting. We'll have to look deeper into that.
Yeah, we will do that. We will definitely do that. Scott, I think Trey's younger daughter was born in spring of 97. That's what he mentioned that in the when we were talking about that recently.
So that could be it.
Maybe Paige's? I don't know. Yeah, maybe
Sophie
just
was pregnant during the meat stick thing in 2000. I don't know.
No, earlier. I don't know.
We're going to have to find out. But Scott, we know that you ended up going to more fish shows after this. So presumably you had a good time and wanted to see more.
Yeah, I was in Rhode Island and they did an island tour. And so I was two towns away for those Providence shows and had family out in Indiana. So I was out for the Deer Creek shows and made it work.
Did you get a car by then, or did your parents have to drive you again to those?
No,
shows?
Neither. I didn't get a car till junior year. And then my grades definitely suffered when I that fall 99 tour. I got around. I was able to make things work with other friends, and you know, it's certainly nicer to be self-sufficient at that point.
That's what it's all about, being self-sufficient and having friends and being part of this incredible community that is the fish community.
It is. Scott, I have to just ask one last thing. Do you remember what you felt like after the show? Or like walking out of this, I mean, because you had been listening to them for a while, and I think we all remember our first show, but maybe not Tom, but most of us remember our first shows. Like how, you know, how it was different or similar to what we were expecting, or just what was it like after?
It's just, I think, a level of awe. I mean, I had seen some live music at that point, and to finally see my first fish show, I remember lying at home and my ears were ringing because I wasn't wearing earplugs at the time and didn't get around to that for 13 years. yeah, kids, earplugs. But it was, yeah. It was a really special experience. And I knew that I had seen something that I wanted to keep seeing. Just had that level of joy. It was fantastic.
I think that's a great place for us to stop today. Thank you so much, Scott Marks, and thank you to all listeners, and thanks to the OSIRIS team. And I'd like to give a quick shout out to Cash or Trade, the world's only social network where fans buy, sell, and trade tickets at face value. Check them out at cashortrade.org. And please remember also to review and subscribe wherever you listen or watch. and goodbye. And please remember to blaze on. And I do have a note about blaze on. A lot of people ask me, and these might not be fish fans. These might just be fans listening to, I'm not sure, but I've had at least three people ask me why I say blaze on at the end. And apart from the obvious double meaning, I'm talking about what Robert Frost was talking about, you know, the great American poet. He said in The Road Not Taken, two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less traveled by, and that has made all the difference. And that's what I'm tapping into, or is trying, in Blaze On. So blaze your own trail through life, and thank you, everybody. Thanks, RJ. Thank you, Scott.
Osiris.
What's up, everybody? I am Finn McKenty, host of the Punk Rock NBA podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. My podcast is all about doing what you love for a living, and every week I sit down and talk to people who have done exactly that. For example, musicians like Tommy from Between the Buried and Me, Matt from Periphery, Lil Lotus and Shinigami, among many others, photographers, artists, designers, YouTubers like Glenn Fricker and Sarah Dici, and I unpack exactly how they got to where they are today with the goal of helping you do the same. So if that sounds cool, you can listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com, and I'll see you there.
Hey, this is Steve Choi, host of the Musicians Guild podcast, part of the Sound Talent Media podcast network. Within the four walls of the Musicians Guild, we'll be discussing the habits, idiosyncrasies, experiences, and general psychology of my friends and peers all involved with music in various capacities. Listen and subscribe at soundtalentmedia.com.